of the fact that others are making conscious choices and are in turn thinking about what he himself is thinking, and so on. The games we consider in the next several chapters will elucidate the reasoning and solution tools for simultaneous move games. In this tools chapter, however, we focus solely on sequential move games, as exemplified by 21 flags, and, at a much higher level of complexity, chess. Do people actually solve games by backward reasoning? Backward reasoning along a tree is the correct way to analyze and solve games where the players move sequentially. Those who fail to do so, either explicitly or intuitively, are harming their own objectives. They should read our book or hire a strategic consultant. But that is an advisory or normative use of the theory of backward reasoning. Does the theory have the usual explanatory or positive value that most scientific theories do? In other words, do we observe the correct outcomes from the play of actual games? Researchers in the new and exciting fields of behavioral economics and behavioral game theory have conducted experiments that yield mixed evidence. What seems to be the most damaging criticism comes from the ultimatum game. This is the simplest possible negotiation game. There is just one take-it-or-leave-it offer. The ultimatum game has two players. A proposer, say A, a responder, say B, and a sum of money, say $100. Player A begins the game by proposing a division of the $100 between the two. Then B decides whether to agree to A's proposal. If B agrees, the proposal is implemented. Each player gets what A proposed, and the game ends. If B refuses, then neither player gets anything, and the game ends. A quick trip to the gym. Reverse ultimatum game. In the variant of the ultimatum game, A makes an offer to B about how to divide up the $100. If B says yes, the money is divided up and the game is over. But if B says no, then A must decide whether to make another offer or not. Each subsequent offer from A must be more generous to B. The game ends when either B says yes or A stops making offers. How do you predict this game will end up? In this case, we can suppose that A will keep on making offers until he has proposed 99 to B and 1 for himself. Thus, according to tree logic, B should get almost all of the pie. If you were B, would you hold out for 99 to 1? We'd advise against it. Pause a minute and think. If you were playing this game in the A role, what division would you propose? Now, think how this game would be played by two people who are rational from the point of view of conventional economic theory. That is, each is concerned only with his or her self-interest and can calculate perfectly the optimal strategies to pursue that interest. The proposer, A, would think as follows. No matter what split I propose, B is left with the choice between that and nothing. The game is played only once, so B has no reason to develop a reputation for toughness or to engage in any tit-for-tat response to A's actions. So B will accept whatever I offer. I can do best for myself by offering B as little as possible, for example, just 1 cent, if that is the minimum permissible under the rules of the game. Therefore, A would offer this minimum and B would accept. This argument is another example of tree logic without drawing a tree. Pause and think again. If you were playing this game in the B role, would you accept 1 cent? Numerous experiments have been conducted on this game. Typically, 2 dozen or so subjects are brought together and are matched randomly in pairs. In each pair, the roles of proposer and responder are assigned, and the game is played once. New pairs are formed at random, and the game played again. Usually, the players do not know with whom they are matched in any one play of the game. Thus, The experimenter gets several observations from the same pool in the same session, but there is no possibility of forming ongoing relationships that can affect behavior. Within this general framework, many variations of conditions are attempted to study their effects on the outcomes. Your own introspection of how you would act as proposer and as responder has probably led you to believe that the results of actual play of this game should differ from the theoretical prediction above. And indeed, they differ, often dramatically so. The amounts offered to the responder differ across proposers, but 1 cent or $1, or in fact anything below 10% of the total sum at stake, is very rare. The median offer, half of the proposers offer less than that and half offer more, is in the 40 to 50% range. In many experiments, a 50-50 split is the single most frequent proposal. Proposals that would give the responder less than 20% are rejected about half the time. Irrationality versus other regarding rationality. Why do proposers offer substantial shares to the responders? Three reasons suggest themselves. First, the proposers may be unable to do the correct backward reasoning. Second, the proposers may have motives other than the pure selfish desire to get as much as they can. They act altruistically or care about fairness. Third, they may fear that responders would reject low offers. The first is unlikely because the logic of backward reasoning is so simple in this game. In more complex situations, players may fail to do the necessary calculations fully or correctly, especially if they are novices to the game being played, as we saw in 21 Flags. But the ultimatum game is surely simple enough even for novices. The explanation must be the second, the third, or a combination thereof. Early results from ultimatum experiments favored the third. In fact, Harvard's Al Roth and his co-authors found that, given the pattern of rejection thresholds that prevailed in their subject pool, the proposers were choosing their offers to achieve an optimal balance between the prospect of obtaining a greater share for themselves against the risk of rejection. This suggests a remarkable conventional rationality on part of the proposers. However, later work to distinguish the second and the third possibilities led to a different idea. To distinguish between altruism and strategy, experiments were done using a variant called the dictator game. Here the proposer dictates how the available total is to be split. The other player has no say in the matter at all. Proposers in the dictator game give away significantly smaller sums on average than they offer in the ultimatum game, but they give away substantially more than zero. Thus, there is something to both of those explanations. Proposers' behavior in the ultimatum game has both generous and strategic aspects. Is the generosity driven by altruism or by a concern for fairness? Both explanations are different aspects of what might be called a regard for others in people's preferences. Another variation of the experiment helps tell these two possibilities apart. In the usual setup, after the pairs are formed, the roles of proposer and responder are assigned by a random mechanism like a coin toss. This may build in a notion of equality or fairness in the players' minds. To remove this, a variant assigns the roles by holding a preliminary contest, such as a test of general knowledge, and making its winner the proposer. This creates some sense of entitlement to the proposer, and indeed leads to offers that are on average about 10% smaller. However, the offers remain substantially above zero, indicating that proposers have an element of altruism in their thinking. Remember that they do not know the identity of the responders, so this must be a generalized sense of altruism, not concern for the well-being of a particular person. A third variation of individual preferences is also possible. Contributions may be driven by a sense of shame. Jason Dana of the University of Illinois, Dalian Kane of Yale School of Management, and Robin Dawes of Carnegie Mellon University performed an experiment with the following variation of the dictator game. The dictator is asked to allocate $10. After the allocation is made, but before it is delivered to the other party, the dictator is given the following offer. You can have $9, the other party will get nothing, and they will never know that they were part of this experiment. Most dictators accept this offer. Thus, they would rather give up a dollar to ensure that the other person never knows how greedy they were. An altruistic person would prefer keeping $9 and giving away $1 to keeping $9 while the other person gets nothing. Even when a dictator had offered $3, he would rather take that away to keep the other person in the dark. This is much like incurring a large cost to cross the street to avoid making a small donation to a beggar. Observe two things about these experiments. First, they follow the standard methodology of science. Hypotheses are tested by designing appropriate variations of controls in the experiment. We mention a few prominent variations of this kind here. Many more are discussed in Colin Kamerer's book cited in Chapter 2, Note 6. Second, in the social sciences, multiple causes often coexist, each contributing part of the explanation for the same phenomenon. Hypotheses don't have to be either fully correct or totally wrong. Accepting one need not mean rejecting all others. Now consider the behavior of the responders. Why do they reject an offer when they know that the alternative is to get even less? The reason cannot be to establish a reputation for being a tough negotiator that may bear fruit in future plays of this game or other games of division. The same pair does not play repeatedly, and no track record of one player's past behavior is made available to future partners. Even if a reputational motive is implicitly present, it must take a deeper form. A general rule for action that the responder follows without doing any explicit thinking or calculation in each instance. It must be an instinctive action or an emotion-driven response. And that is indeed the case. In a new emerging line of experimental research called neuroeconomics, the subject's brain activity is scanned using functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, or positron emission tomography, PET, while they make various economic decisions. When ultimatum games are played under such conditions, it is found that the responder's anterior insula shows more activity as the proposer's offers become more unequal. Since the anterior insula is active for emotions, such as anger and disgust, this result helps explain why second movers reject unequal offers. Conversely, the left side prefrontal cortex is more active when an unequal offer is accepted, indicating that conscious control is being exercised to balance between acting on one's disgust and getting more money. Many people, especially economists, argue that while responders may reject small shares of the small sums that are typically on offer in laboratory experiments, in the real world, where stakes are often much larger, rejection must be very unlikely. To test this, ultimatum game experiments have been conducted in poorer countries where the amounts were worth several months' income for the participants. Rejection does become somewhat less likely, but offers do not become significantly less generous. The consequences of rejection become more serious for the proposers, just as they do for the responders, so proposers, fearing rejection, are likely to behave more cautiously. Although behavior can be explained in part by instincts, hormones, or emotions hardwired into the brain, part of it varies from one culture to another. In experiments conducted across many countries, it was found that the perception of what constitutes a reasonable offer varied by up to 10% across cultures, but properties like aggressiveness or toughness varied less. Only one group differed substantially from the rest. Among the Machiganga of the Peruvian Amazon, the offers were much smaller, average 26%, and only one offer was rejected. Anthropologists explain that the Machiganga live in small family units, are socially disconnected, and have no norms of sharing. Conversely, in two cultures, the offers exceeded 50%. These have the custom of lavish giving when one has a stroke of good luck, which places an obligation on the recipients to return the favor even more generously in the future. This norm or habit seems to carry over to the experiment even though the players do not know whom they are giving to or receiving from. Evolution of altruism and fairness. What should we learn from the findings of these experiments on the ultimatum game and others like them? Many of the outcomes do differ significantly from what we would expect based on the theory of backward reasoning, with the assumption that each player cares only about his or her own reward. Which of the two, correct backward calculation or selfishness, is the wrong assumption, or is it a combination? And what are the implications? Consider backward reasoning first. We saw the players on Survivor fail to do this correctly or fully in 21 Flags. But they were playing the game for the first time, and even then their discussion revealed glimpses of the correct reasoning. Our classroom experience shows that students learn the full strategy after playing the game or watching it played just 3 or 4 times. Many experiments inevitably and almost deliberately work with novice subjects whose actions in the game are often steps in the process of learning the game. In the real world of business, politics, and professional sports, where people are experienced at playing the games they are involved in, we should expect that the players have accumulated much more learning and that they play generally good strategies either by calculation or by trained instinct. For somewhat more complex games, strategically aware players can use computers or consultants to do the calculations. This practice is still somewhat rare, but is sure to spread. Therefore, we believe that backward reasoning should remain our starting point for analysis of such games and for predicting their outcomes. This first pass at the analysis can then be modified as necessary in a particular context to recognize that beginners may make mistakes and that some games may become too complex to be solved unaided. We believe that the more important lesson from the experimental research is that people bring many considerations and preferences into their choices besides their own rewards. This takes us beyond the scope of conventional economic theory. Game theorists should include in their analysis of games the players' concerns for fairness or altruism. Behavioral game theory extends rationality rather than abandoning it. This is all to the good. A better understanding of people's motives enriches our understanding of economic decision-making and strategic interactions alike, and that is already happening. Frontier research in game theory increasingly includes in the players' objectives their concerns for equity, altruism, and similar concerns, and even a second-round concern to reward or punish others whose behavior reflects or violates these precepts. But we should not stop there. We should go one step further and think about why concerns for altruism and fairness and anger or disgust when someone else violates these precepts, have such a strong hold on people. This takes us into the realm of speculation, but one plausible explanation can be found in evolutionary psychology. Groups that instill norms of fairness and altruism into their members will have less internal conflict than groups consisting of purely selfish individuals. Therefore, they will be more successful in taking collective action, such as provision of goods that benefit the whole group and conservation of common resources, and they will spend less effort and resources in internal conflict. As a result, they will do better both in absolute terms and in competition with groups that do not have similar norms. In other words, some measure of fairness and altruism may have evolutionary survival value. Some biological evidence for rejecting unfair offers comes from an experiment run by Terry Burnham. In his version of the ultimatum game, the amount at stake was $40, and the subjects were male Harvard graduate students. The divider was given only two choices: offer $25 and keep $15, or offer $5 and keep $35. Among those offered only $5, 20 students accepted, and 6 rejected, giving themselves and the divider both 0. Now for the punchline. It turns out that the six who rejected the offer had testosterone levels 50% higher than those who accepted the offer. To the extent that testosterone is connected with status and aggression, this could provide a genetic link that might explain an evolutionary advantage of what evolutionary biologist Robert Trivers has called moralistic aggression. In addition to a potential genetic link, societies have non-genetic ways of passing on norms, namely the processes of education and socialization of infants and children in families and schools. We see parents and teachers telling impressionable children the importance of caring for others, sharing, and being nice. Some of this undoubtedly remains imprinted in their minds and influences their behavior throughout their lives. Finally, we should point out that fairness and altruism have their limit. Long-run progress and success of a society need innovation and change. These, in turn, require individualism and a willingness to defy social norms and conventional wisdom. Selfishness often accompanies these characteristics. We need the right balance between self-regarding and other-regarding behaviors. Very complex trees. When you have acquired a little experience with backward reasoning, you will find that many strategic situations in everyday life or work lend themselves to tree logic without the need to draw and analyze trees explicitly. Many other games at an intermediate level of complexity can be solved using computer software packages that are increasingly available for this purpose. But for complex games such as chess, a complete solution by backward reasoning is simply not feasible. In principle, chess is the ideal game of sequential moves amenable to solution by backward reasoning. The players alternate moves. All previous moves are observable and irrevocable. There is no uncertainty about the position or the player's motives. The rule that the game is a draw if the same position is repeated ensures that the game ends within a finite total number of moves. We can start with the terminal nodes, or endpoints, and work backward. However, practice and principle are two different things. It has been estimated that the total number of nodes in chess is about 10 to the 120th power, that is, 1 with 120 zeros after it. A supercomputer, 1,000 times as fast as the typical PC, would need 10 to the 103rd power years to examine them all. Waiting for that is futile. Foreseeable progress in computers is not likely to improve matters significantly. In the meantime, what have chess players and programmers of chess-playing computers done? Chess experts have been successful at characterizing optimal strategies near the end of the game. Once the chessboard has only a small number of pieces on it, experts are able to look ahead to the end of the game and determine by backward reasoning whether one side has a guaranteed win or whether the other side can obtain a draw. But the middle of the game, when several pieces remain on the board, is far harder. Looking ahead 5 pairs of moves, which is about as much as can be done by experts in a reasonable amount of time, is not going to simplify the situation to a point where the end game can be solved completely from there on. The pragmatic solution is a combination of forward-looking analysis and value judgment. The former is the science of game theory, looking ahead and reasoning backward. The latter is the art of the practitioner, being able to judge the value of a position from the number and interconnections of the pieces without finding an explicit solution of the game from that point onward. Chess players often speak of this as knowledge. But you can call it experience or instinct or art. The best chess players are usually distinguished by the depth and subtlety of their knowledge. Knowledge can be distilled from the observation of many games and many players and then codified into rules. This has been done most extensively with regard to openings, that is, the first 10 or even 15 moves of a game. There are hundreds and hundreds of books that analyze different openings and discuss their relative merits and drawbacks. How do computers fit into this picture? At one time, the project of programming computers to play chess was seen as an integral part of the emerging science of artificial intelligence. The aim was to design computers that would think as humans do. This did not succeed for many years. Then, the attention shifted to using computers to do what they do best, crunch numbers. Computers can look ahead to more moves and do this more quickly than humans can. Using pure number crunching, by the late 1990s, dedicated chess computers like Fritz and Deep Blue could compete with the top human players. More recently, computers have been programmed with some knowledge of mid-game positions imparted by some of the best human players. Human players have ratings determined by their performances. The best-ranked computers are already achieving ratings comparable to the 2,800 enjoyed by the world's strongest human player, Garry Kasparov. In November 2003, Kasparov played a four-game match against the latest version of the Fritz computer X3D. The result was one victory each and two draws. In July 2005, the Hydra chess computer demolished Michael Adams, ranked number 13 in the world, winning five games and drawing one in a six-game match. It may not be long before the rival computers rank at the top and play each other for world championships. What should you take away from this account of chess? It shows the method for thinking about any highly complex games you may face. You should combine the rule of look ahead and reason back with your experience, which guides you in evaluating the intermediate positions reached at the end of your span of forward calculation. Success will come from such synthesis of the science of game theory and the art of playing a specific game, not from either alone. Being of two minds. Chess strategy illustrates another important practical feature of looking forward and reasoning backward. You have to play the game from the perspective of both players. While it is hard to calculate your best move in a complicated tree, it is even harder to predict what the other side will do. If you really could analyze all possible moves and countermoves, and the other player could as well, then the two of you would agree up front as to how the entire game would play out. But once the analysis is limited to looking down only some branches of the tree, the other player may see something you didn't, or miss something you've seen. Either way, the other side may then make a move you didn't anticipate. To really look forward and reason backward, you have to predict what the other players will actually do, not what you would have done in their shoes. The problem is that when you try to put yourself in the other player's shoes, it is hard, if not impossible, to leave your own shoes behind. You know too much about what you are planning to do in your next move, and it is hard to erase that knowledge when you are looking at the game from the other player's perspective. Indeed, that explains why people don't play chess or poker against themselves. You certainly can't bluff against yourself or make a surprise attack. There is no perfect solution to this problem. When you try to put yourself in the other player's shoes, you have to know what they know and not know what they don't know. Your objectives have to be their objectives, not what you wish they had as an objective. In practice, firms trying to simulate the moves and countermoves of a potential business scenario will hire outsiders to play the role of the other players. That way, they can ensure that their game partners don't know too much. Often, the biggest learning comes from seeing the moves that were not anticipated and then understanding what led to that outcome, so that it can be either avoided or promoted. To end this chapter, we return to Charlie Brown's problem of whether or not to kick the football. This question became a real issue for football coach Tom Osborne in the final minutes of his championship game. We think he too got it wrong. Backward reasoning will reveal the mistake. Case study: The Tale of Tom Osborne and the 84 Orange Bowl. In the 1984 Orange Bowl, the undefeated Nebraska Cornhuskers and the once-beaten Miami Hurricanes faced off. Because Nebraska came into the bowl with the better record, it needed only a tie in order to finish the season with the number one ranking. Coming into the fourth quarter, Nebraska was behind, 31-17. Then the Cornhuskers began a comeback. They scored a touchdown to make the score 31-23. Nebraska coach Tom Osborne had an important strategic decision to make. In college football, a team that scores a touchdown then runs one play from a hash mark 2.5 yards from the goal line. The team has a choice between trying to run or pass the ball into the end zone, which scores 2 additional points, or trying the less risky strategy of kicking the ball through the goalposts, which scores 1 extra point. Coach Osborne chose to play it safe, and Nebraska successfully kicked for the 1 extra point. Now the score was 31-24. The Cornhuskers continued their comeback. In the waning minutes of the game, they scored a final touchdown, bringing the score to 31-30. A 1-point conversion would have tied the game and landed them the title. But that would have been an unsatisfying victory. To win the championship with style, Osborne recognized that he had to go for the win. The Cornhuskers went for the win with a 2-point conversion attempt. Irving Fryer got the ball but failed to score. Miami and Nebraska ended the year with equal records. Since Miami beat Nebraska, it was Miami that was awarded the top place in the standings. Put yourself in the cleats of Coach Osborne. Could you have done better? Case discussion. Many Monday morning quarterbacks fault Osborne for going for the win rather than the tie. But that is not our bone of contention. Given that Osborne was willing to take the additional risk for the win, he did it the wrong way. He would have done better to first try the 2-point conversion. If it succeeded, then go for the 1 point. If it failed, attempt a second 2-pointer. Let us look at this more carefully. When down by 14 points, he knew that he needed 2 touchdowns plus 3 extra points. He chose to go for the 1 point and then the 2. If both attempts succeeded, the order in which they were made becomes irrelevant. If the 1-point conversion was missed but the 2-point was successful, here too the order is irrelevant and the game ends up tied with Nebraska getting the championship. The only difference occurs if Nebraska misses the 2-point conversion. Under Osborne's plan, that results in the loss of the game and the championship. If instead they had tried the 2-point conversion first, then if it failed, they would not necessarily have lost the game. They would have been behind 31-23. When they scored their next touchdown, this would have brought them to 31-29. A successful 2-point attempt would tie the game and win the No. 1 ranking. Furthermore, this would be a tie that resulted from the failed attempt to win, so no one would criticize Osborne for playing to tie. We have heard the counter-argument that if Osborne went for the 2-pointer first and missed, his team would have been playing for the tie. This would have provided less inspiration, and perhaps they might not have scored the second touchdown. Moreover, by waiting until the end and going for the desperation win-lose 2-pointer, his team would rise to the occasion knowing everything was on the line. This argument is wrong for several reasons. Remember that if Nebraska waits until the second touchdown and then misses the 2-point attempt, they lose. If they miss the 2-point attempt on their first try, there is still a chance for a tie. Even though the chance may be diminished, something is better than nothing. The momentum argument is also flawed. While Nebraska's offense may rise to the occasion in a single play for the championship, we expect the Hurricanes' defense to rise as well. The play is important for both sides. To the extent that there is a momentum effect, if Osborne makes the 2-point conversion on the first touchdown, this should increase the chance of scoring another touchdown. It also allows him to tie the game with 2 field goals. One of the general morals of this story is that if you have to take some risks, it is often better to do so as quickly as possible. This is obvious for those who play tennis. Everyone knows to take more risk on the first serve and hit the second serve more cautiously. That way, if you fail on your first attempt, the game won't be over. You may still have time to take some other options that bring you back to or even ahead of where you were. The wisdom of taking risks early applies to most aspects of life, whether it be career choices, investments, or dating. For more practice using the principle of look forward, reason backward, have a look at the following case studies in Chapter 14. Here's mud in your eye, red I win, black you lose, the shark repellent that backfired, tough guy, tender offer, the three-way duel, and winning without knowing how. Chapter 3. Prisoners' Dilemmas and How to Resolve Them. Many contexts, one concept. What do the following situations have in common? Two gas stations at the same corner, or two supermarkets in the same neighborhood, sometimes get into fierce price wars with each other. In general election campaigns, both the Democratic and the Republican parties in the United States often adopt centrist policies to attract the swing voters in the middle of the political spectrum, ignoring their core supporters who hold more extreme views to the left and the right, respectively. The diversity and productivity of New England fisheries was once unequaled. A continuing trend over the past century has been the overexploitation and eventual collapse of species after species: Atlantic halibut, ocean perch, haddock, and yellowtail flounder have joined the ranks of species written off as commercially extinct. Near the end of Joseph Heller's celebrated novel Catch-22, the Second World War is almost won. Yossarian does not want to be among the last to die. It won't make any difference to the outcome. He explains this to Major Danby, his superior officer. When Danby asks, "But Yossarian, suppose everyone felt that way?" Yossarian replies, "Then I'd certainly be a damned fool to feel any other way, wouldn't I?" Answer: they are all instances of the prisoner's dilemma. As in the interrogation of Dick Hickok and Perry Smith, from In Cold Blood, recounted in Chapter 1, each has a personal incentive to do something that ultimately leads to a result that is bad for everyone when everyone, similarly, does what his or her personal interest dictates. If one confesses, the other had better confess to avoid the really harsh sentence reserved for recalcitrants. If one holds out, the other can cut himself a much better deal by confessing. Indeed, the force is so strong that each prisoner's temptation to confess exists regardless of whether the two are guilty, as was the case in In Cold Blood, or innocent and being framed by the police, as in the movie L.A. Confidential. Price wars are no different. If Nexon gas station charges a low price, the Lenoco station had better set its own price low to avoid losing too many customers. If Nexon prices its gas high, Lenoco can divert many customers its way by pricing low. But when both stations price low, neither makes money, though customers are better off. If the Democrats adopt a platform that appeals to the middle, the Republicans may stand to lose all these voters and therefore the election if they cater only to their core supporters in the economic and social right wings. If the Democrats cater to their core supporters in the minorities and the unions, then the Republicans can capture the middle and therefore win a large majority by being more centrist. If all others fish conservatively, one fisherman going for a bigger catch is not going to deplete the fishery to any significant extent. If all others are fishing aggressively, then any single fisherman would be a fool to try single-handed conservation. The result is overfishing and extinction. Yossarian's logic is what makes it so difficult to continue to support a failed war. A little history. How did theorists devise and name this game that captures so many economic, political, and social interactions? It happened very early in the history of the subject. Harold Kuhn, himself one of the pioneers of game theory, recounted the story in a symposium held in conjunction with the 1994 Nobel Prize Award ceremonies. Al Tucker was on leave at Stanford in the spring of 1950, and because of the shortage of offices, he was housed in the psychology department. One day, a psychologist knocked on his door and asked what he was doing. Tucker replied, "I'm working on game theory," and the psychologist asked if he would give a seminar on his work. For that seminar, Al Tucker invented Prisoner's Dilemma as an example of game theory, Nash equilibria, and the attendant paradoxes of non-socially desirable equilibria. A truly seminal example, it inspired dozens of research papers and several entire books. Others tell a slightly different story. According to them, the mathematical structure of the game predates Tucker and can be attributed to two mathematicians, Merrill Flood and Melvin Drescher, at the Rand Corporation, a Cold War think tank. Tucker's genius was to invent the story illustrating the mathematics. And genius it was because presentation can make or break an idea. A memorable presentation spreads and is assimilated in the community of thinkers far better and faster, whereas a dull and dry presentation may be overlooked or forgotten. A visual representation. We will develop the method for displaying and solving the game using a business example. Rainbow's End and B.B. Lean are rival mail order firms that sell clothes. Every fall, they print and mail their winter catalogs. Each firm must honor the prices printed in its catalog for the whole winter season. The preparation time for the catalogs is much longer than the mailing window, so the two firms must make their pricing decisions simultaneously and without knowing the other firm's choices. They know that the catalogs go to a common pool of potential customers who are smart shoppers and are looking for low prices. Both catalogs usually feature an almost identical item, say, a chambray deluxe shirt. The cost of each shirt to each firm is $20. The firms have estimated that if they each charge $80 for this item, each will sell 1,200 shirts, so each will make a profit of 80 minus 20 times 1,200 equals $72,000. Moreover, it turns out that this price serves their joint interests best. If the firms can collude and charge a common price, $80 is the price that will maximize their combined profits. The firms have estimated that if one of them cuts its price by $1 while the other holds its price unchanged, then the price cutter gains 100 customers, 80 of whom shift to it from the other firm and 20 who are new. For example, they might decide to buy the shirt when they would not have at the higher price, or might switch from a store in their local mall. Therefore, each firm has the temptation to undercut the other to gain more customers. The whole purpose of this story is to figure out how these temptations play out. We begin by supposing that each firm chooses between just two prices, $80 and $70. If one firm cuts its price to $70 while the other is still charging $80, the price cutter gains 1,000 customers and the other loses 800. So the price cutter sells 2,200 shirts while the other's sales drop to 400. The profits are 70 minus 20 times 2,200 equals $110,000 for the price cutter, and 80 minus 20 times 400 equals $24,000 for the other firm. What happens if both firms cut their price to $70 at the same time? If both firms reduce their price by $1, existing customers stay put, but each gains the 20 new customers. So when both reduce their price by $10, each gains 10 times 20 equals 200 net sales above the previous 1,200. Each sells 1,400 and makes a profit of 70 minus 20 times 1,400 equals $70,000. We want to display the profit consequences, the firm's payoffs in their game, visually. However, we cannot do this using a game tree like the ones in Chapter 2. Here the two players act simultaneously. Neither can make his move knowing what the other has done or anticipating how the other will respond. Instead, each must think about what the other is thinking at the same time. A starting point for this thinking about thinking is to lay out all the consequences of all the combinations of the simultaneous choices the two could make. Since each has two alternatives, $80 or $70, there are four such combinations. we can display them most easily in a spreadsheet-like format of rows and columns, which we will generally refer to as a gain table or payoff table. The choices of rainbow's end, RE for short, are arrayed along the rows, and those of BB lean, BB, along the columns. In each of the four cells corresponding to each choice of a row by RE and a column by BB, we show two numbers, the profit, in thousands of dollars, from selling this shirt. In each cell, the number in the southwest corner belongs to the row player, and the number in the northeast corner belongs to the column player. In the jargon of game theory, these numbers are called payoffs. Generally, higher payoff numbers are better for each player. Sometimes, as with prisoners under interrogation, the payoff numbers are years in jail, so each player prefers a smaller number for himself. The same can happen if the payoff numbers are ranking where one is best. When looking at a game table, you should check the interpretation of the payoff numbers of that game. To make it abundantly clear which payoffs belong to which player, we have also put the numbers in two different shades of gray for this example. Before we solve the game, let us observe and emphasize one feature of it. Compare the payoff pairs across the four cells. A better outcome for RE does not always imply a worse outcome for BB, or vice versa. Specifically, both of them are better off in the top left cell than in the bottom right cell. This game need not end with a winner and a loser. It is not zero sum. We similarly pointed out in Chapter 2 that the Charlie Brown investment game was not zero sum, and neither are most games we meet in reality. In many games, as in the Prisoner's Dilemma, the issue will be how to avoid a lose-lose outcome or to achieve a win-win outcome. The Dilemma. Now consider the reasoning of RE's manager. If BB chooses $80, I can get $110,000 instead of $72,000 by cutting my price to $70. If BB chooses $70, then my payoff is $70,000 if I also charge $70, but only $24,000 if I charge $80. So in both cases, choosing $70 is better than choosing $80. My better choice, in fact my best choice, since I have only two alternatives, is the same no matter what BB chooses. I don't need to think through their thinking at all. I should just go ahead and set my price at $70. When a simultaneous move game has this special feature, namely that for a player the best choice is the same regardless of what the other player or players choose, it greatly simplifies the player's thinking and the game theorist's analysis. Therefore, it is worth making a big deal of it and looking for it to simplify the solution of the game. The name given by game theorists for this property is dominant strategy. A player is said to have a dominant strategy if that same strategy is better for him than all of his other available strategies, no matter what strategy or strategy combination the other player or players choose. And we have a simple rule for behavior in simultaneous move games. In Chapter 2, we could offer a single unifying principle to devise the best strategies for games with sequential moves. This was our Rule 1. Look forward and reason backward. It won't be so simple for simultaneous move games, but the thinking about thinking required for simultaneous moves can be summarized in three simple rules for action. These rules, in turn, rest on two simple ideas: dominant strategies and equilibrium. Rule 2. If you have a dominant strategy, use it. The Prisoner's Dilemma is an even more special game. Not just one player, but both or all players have dominant strategies. The reasoning of BB's manager is exactly analogous to that of RE's manager, and you should fix the idea by going through it on your own. You will see that $70 is also the dominant strategy for BB. The result is the outcome shown in the bottom right cell of the game table. Both charge $70 and make a profit of $70,000 each. And here is the feature that makes the Prisoner's Dilemma such an important game. When both players use their dominant strategies, both do worse than they would have if somehow they could have jointly and credibly agreed that each would choose the other, dominated strategy. In this game, that would have meant charging $80 each to obtain the outcome in the top left cell of the game table, namely $72,000 each. Actually, $80 is the common price that yields the two highest possible joint profit. That is the price they would choose if they could get together and cartelize the industry. Rigorous proof of this statement requires some math, so just take our word for it. For readers who want to follow the calculation, it is on the book's website. It would not be enough for just one of them to price at $80. Then that firm would do very badly. Somehow, they must both be induced to price high, and this is hard to achieve given the temptation each of them has to try to undercut the other. Each firm pursuing its own self-interest does not lead to an outcome that is best for them all, in stark contrast to what conventional theories of economics from Adam Smith onward have taught us. The beneficiaries from this price-cutting by the firms are, of course, the consumers, who are not active players in this game. This opens up a host of questions, some of which pertain to more general aspects of game theory. What happens if only one player has a dominant strategy? What if none of the players has a dominant strategy? When the best choice for each varies depending on what the other is choosing simultaneously, can they see through each other's choices and arrive at a solution to the game? We will take up these questions in the next chapter, where we develop a more general concept of solution for simultaneous move games, namely Nash equilibrium. In this chapter, we focus on questions about the prisoner's dilemma game per se. In the general context, the two strategies available to each player are labeled cooperate and defect, or sometimes cheat, and we will follow this usage. Defect is the dominant strategy for each, and the combination where both choose defect yields a worse outcome for both than if both choose cooperate. Some preliminary ideas for resolving the dilemma. The players caught on the horns of this dilemma have strong incentives to make joint agreements to avoid it. For example, the fishermen in New England might agree to limit their catch to preserve the fish stocks for the future. The difficulty is to make such agreements stick when each faces the temptation to cheat, for example, to take more than one's allotted quota of fish. What does game theory have to say on this issue? And what happens in the actual play of such games? In the 50 years since the prisoner's dilemma game was invented, its theory has advanced a great deal, and much evidence has accumulated, both from observations about the real world and from controlled experiments in laboratory settings. Let us look at all this material and see what we can learn from it. The flip side of achieving cooperation is avoiding defection. A player can be given the incentive to choose cooperation rather than the originally dominant strategy of defection by giving him a suitable reward, or deterred from defecting by creating the prospect of a suitable punishment. The reward approach is problematic for several reasons. Rewards can be internal. One player pays the other for taking the cooperative action. Sometimes they can be external. Some third party that also benefits from the two players' cooperation pays them for cooperating. In either case, the reward cannot be given before the choice is made. Otherwise, the player will simply pocket the reward and then defect. If the reward is merely promised, the promise may not be credible. After the promisee has chosen cooperation, the promisor may renege. These difficulties notwithstanding, rewards are sometimes feasible and useful. At an extreme of creativity and imagination, the players could make simultaneous and mutual promises and make these credible by depositing the promised rewards in an escrow account controlled by a third party. More realistically, sometimes the players interact in several dimensions, and cooperation in one can be rewarded with reciprocation in another. For example, among groups of female chimpanzees, help with grooming is reciprocated by sharing food or help with childminding. Sometimes, third parties may have sufficiently strong interests in bringing about cooperation in a game. For example, in the interest of bringing to an end various conflicts around the world, The United States and the European Union have from time to time promised economic assistance to combatants as a reward for peaceful resolutions of their disputes. The United States rewarded Israel and Egypt in this way for cooperating to strike the Camp David Accords in 1978. Punishment is the more usual method of resolving prisoners' dilemmas. This could be immediate. In a scene from the movie L.A. Confidential, Sergeant Ed Exley promises Leroy Fontaine, one of the suspects he is interrogating, that if he turns state's witness, he will get a shorter sentence than the other two, Sugar Ray Coates and Tyrone Jones. But Leroy knows that when he emerges from jail, he may find friends of the other two waiting for him. But the punishment that comes to mind most naturally in this context arises from the fact that most such games are parts of an ongoing relationship. Cheating may gain one player a short-term advantage, but this can harm the relationship and create a longer-run cost. If this cost is sufficiently large, that can act as a deterrent against cheating in the first place. A striking example comes from baseball. Batters in the American League are hit by pitches 11 to 17% more often than their colleagues in the National League. According to Suwanee professors Doug Drinan and John Charles Bradbury, most of this difference is explained by the designated hitter rule. In the American League, the pitchers don't bat. Thus, an American League pitcher who plunks a batter doesn't have to fear direct retaliation from the opposing team's pitcher. Although pitchers are unlikely to get hit, the chance goes up by a factor of 4 if they have just plunked someone in the previous half inning. The fear of retaliation is clear. As ace pitcher Curt Schilling explained, "Are you seriously going to throw at someone when you are facing Randy Johnson?" When most people think about one player punishing the other for past cheating, they think of some version of tit for tat. And that was indeed the finding of what is perhaps the most famous experiment on the prisoner's dilemma. Let us recount what happened and what it teaches. Tit for tat. In the early 1980s, University of Michigan political scientist Robert Axelrod invited game theorists from around the world to submit their strategies for playing the prisoner's dilemma in the form of computer programs. The programs were matched against each other in pairs to play a prisoner's dilemma game repeated 150 times. Contestants were then ranked by the sum of their scores. The winner was Anatole Rapoport, a mathematics professor at the University of Toronto. His winning strategy was among the simplest, tit for tat. Axelrod was surprised by this. He repeated the tournament with an enlarged set of contestants. Once again, Rapoport submitted tit for tat and beat the competition. Tit for tat is a variation of the eye for an eye rule of behavior. Do unto others as they have done unto you. More precisely, the strategy cooperates in the first period and from then on mimics the rival's actions from the previous period. Axelrod argues that tit-for-tat embodies four principles that should be present in any effective strategy for the repeated prisoner's dilemma: clarity, niceness, provocability, and forgivingness. Tit-for-tat is as clear and simple as you can get. The opponent does not have to do much thinking or calculation about what you are up to. It is nice in that it never initiates cheating. It is provocable, that is, it never lets cheating go unpunished. And it is forgiving, because it does not hold a grudge for too long and is willing to restore cooperation. One of the impressive features about tit for tat is that it did so well overall, even though it did not, nor could it, beat any one of its rivals in a head-on competition. At best, tit for tat ties its rival. Hence, if Axelrod had scored each competition as a winner-take-all contest, tit-for-tat would have only losses and ties, and therefore could not have had the best track record. Since every loser must be paired with a winner, it must be the case that some contestant will have more wins than losses, else there will be more losses than wins overall. The only exception is when every single match is a tie. But Axelrod did not score the pairwise plays as winner-take-all. close counted. The big advantage of tit-for-tat is that it always comes close. At worst, tit-for-tat ends up getting beaten by one defection. That is, it gets taken advantage of once and then ties from then on. The reason tit-for-tat won the tournament is that it usually managed to encourage cooperation whenever possible while avoiding exploitation. The other entries were either too trusting and open to exploitation